Welcome to the podcast of America This Week, courtesy of the Catholic Channel on Sirius XM 129. If you want to listen to more of America This Week, subscribe to Sirius XM and tune in on Wednesdays at 1 p.m. Eastern to the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129. You're listening to America This Week.
We are back. You're listening to America This Week on the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129. Joined this week by Kerry Weber, our editor. Father Matt Malone is away on vacation. And we're joined today by Joseph Leconte, whose book, A Hobbit, A Wardrobe, and a Great War, How J.R.R. Tolkien and C.S. Lewis Rediscovered Faith, Friendship, and Heroism in the Cataclysm of 1914 to 1918. Now, Joseph, perhaps we could talk a little more about, you know, these two individuals, as you say in the book, were really swimming against the tide of the culture at the time, in that they were able to hold on to their faith when so many people, certainly Tolkien and then later rediscovered by Lewis, they held on to their faith at a time when it was very difficult for people to believe in God. How were they able to do that?
Yes, you know, the literary critic Roger Sale, he's called the First World War, quote, the single event most responsible for shaping the modern idea that heroism is dead. That's what these guys are up against in the 1920s and 30s. Nobody's writing heroic stories, good versus evil. How are they able to do it? You know, if you have a faith perspective, a Christian perspective, there is this idea of calling. You have a feeling, a sense of calling on your life. And I think one of the things both these men discovered, Tolkien had this sense earlier than Lewis because Tolkien was a committed Catholic going into the war. Lewis becomes a Christian in the 1930s, as we discussed. And then what do? They form this little group of like-minded scholars, all Christian men, and they meet every week, every Thursday, for about 16 years. And the point of those gatherings is to help one another pursue their callings with excellence. And so they're critiquing each other's work, reading them out loud. Tolkien says that Lewis heard every chapter of The Lord of the Rings read out loud. Every chapter.
That must have been amazing.
And
right?
Lewis would sometimes just weep at the end of a chapter reading from Tolkien. Lewis loved to hear things read out loud, and he had a gift for critiquing a work in that way. And Tolkien went to him more than anyone else for that kind of critique. It shows the depth of their friendship.
And they were meeting in these pubs in Oxford,
right? That's right, which you've been in, right?
Which we went to, and we were like, pretend, they were called the Inklings? Is that what they called them?
The Inklings, those who dabble in ink.
Yeah, and we would just think like, oh my gosh, we're going to like do the same thing, but really we would just, you know, eat ham sandwiches and talk about whatever was going on that week. But I mean, the idea to, and that's wonderful thing about these writers is that they're recent enough that their lives are still sort of real in a way that relates to the modern day life in a sense. They're not so far back that it seems too distant. We could go to these pubs, hang out in the same areas and kind of have these similar discussions. And I think it brings up these Inklings, brings up this idea of fellowship that was so important to both of them.
Yes.
I mean, obviously the Fellowship of the Ring,
you know,
and this idea of these groups kind of coming together and that sense of community. I wonder how the war sort of shaped both of their ideas of community, of fellowship.
That's a fabulous question. And I think part of the answer is think about the comradeship that men and women feel when they're under fire in the trenches. We tend to romanticize that with the Band of Brothers in the Second World War, the idea of fellowship and friendship. That's all true. But the men in the First World War experienced very much the same thing, that an intense comradeship of the guy in that trench next to you who you owe your life to, maybe. And so I think coming out of that war, both of them had that experience, and I think they wanted to replicate something like that experience of deep fellowship now at Oxford in this new setting, in this literary setting. And I think that's why they were so devoted to meeting every week there at the Eagle and the Child and other places. Yeah.
Well, yeah, right. I think you're speaking to the power of community, and that's something many people have written about. They call it fellowship here, but maybe it's something that our own veterans could use. You know, coming out of war, I think that's what a lot of people struggle with, is they have these tight bonds that naturally happen in a warlike environment, and then they leave, and it's a real absence in their life.
Yes, and think about how powerful the theme of friendship is in both those stories. So, I mean, the friendship between Sam and Frodo is kind of one of the moral triumphs of the work, isn't it? When you think about Frodo near the end of his quest, exhausted, he's just about given up. He's crawling on his hands to try to fulfill his calling and his task, and Sam just says, Mr. Frodo, I can't carry it. I can't carry the ring, but I can carry you and it. Come on, Mr. Frodo, get up, dear. I mean, that's what a man who's experienced combat and the fellowship of combat would say in that situation. I think about Tolkien and Lewis and the Chronicles of Narnia. You might actually say that friendship replaces romance in those series of children's novels as the kind of preeminent value. Because think about the friendship between the children and the animals, and then, of course, between the children and Aslan.
Right, all those
who follow Aslan in love and obedience. Friendship is at the heart of that story as well. Again, I think it goes back to the First World War.
Yeah, I remember reading the Chronicles of Narnia as a kid, and I remember thinking, like, I think this Aslan, he's supposed to be like God. Does anyone else know this? You know, like maybe I had figured this out for myself.
And then realizing,
yes, you know what? In fact, people do. But I wonder, what was your first experience of reading some of these books like, and what brought you to them in the first place?
That's a great question. You know, I started reading Tolkien's work much, much later in life, in my 40s, when I was doing my doctoral work in London over there, actually. And it was my great escape from my studies in John Locke during the day. And then it was and then it was Tolkien at night. And I found myself so morally invigorated by the story, even though Tolkien is much less explicit about his Christian sympathies
in
that story. He's more of an apologist. Lewis is more the evangelist, right? So Tolkien says explicitly that his world is kind of a pre-Christian world, but there's a clear moral narrative. There is good and evil. There's a transcendent good, and there is this challenge and obligation for people to make a choice for good or for evil. So I found myself so morally challenged and refreshed and invigorated by Tolkien's work when I read it for the first time just a few years ago, really.
Now, what did they think of each other's work? I mean, you said that they critiqued it, but they're very different in many ways.
Yeah.
As you say, Lewis is a little more explicit, a lot more explicit.
Yeah.
Did they have issues, or were they just great fans of one another?
They did have some issues. I'm glad you asked that question. I mean, Lewis loved Tolkien's trilogy, and he offered constructive criticism, but at the end of the day, he loved the work. He thought it was absolutely magnificent. It captured their own kind of war experience. It captured real life. He was clear to say in various reviews that Lewis wrote glowing reviews of Tolkien's work. He said, it's been accused of being escapist. Tolkien's been accused of being an escapist, but man, you don't escape from real life for a moment. And what I feel as a reader, Lewis says, is this feeling of dread and foreboding, and it's almost too heavy. It's almost too much. So Lewis really just praises Tolkien for his utter realism, his Christian realism. Tolkien, on the other hand, was not that thrilled with Lewis's Chronicles of Narnia. He just thought they were too explicit, too maybe evangelistic. And then the images that he would throw in there, Father Christmas pops up, and that's just driving Tolkien crazy. It's too much going on in there. And also, Lewis is knocking out these novels one every year. Tolkien's been working on his trilogy for like better part of a decade. So there's probably a little rivalry there too as well.
Well, that's human
and
understandable. But it's interesting. In some ways, I think, I mean, maybe it's the attention that the films have brought to these the works by Tolkien, but it seems like perhaps they've worn a little better with the present day audience than some of the Narnia tales have. I mean, may just be my impression.
But they really encourage each other on. I mean, Tolkien says that he never would have finished The Lord of the Rings had it not been for C.S. Lewis's constant encouragement. He says, for a long time, he was his only cheerleader in this work, the whole idea of hobbits. I stayed at the Eastgate Hotel at Oxford during one of my conferences last year, and that's where Tolkien and Lewis, one of the places they would just meet the two of them for lunch, for a pint at the Eastgate. And Tolkien writes a letter to his son, Christopher, saying, met CSL, C.S. Lewis, at the Eastgate for lunch. He was haranguing me to finish my hobbit story. It was quite an ordeal.
Does actually being in there in Oxford sort of connect you to these men in a way that you don't get from their stories itself?
I feel like it does. You just because I'm a very kind of I love the physicality
tactile,
of the thing.
Yeah,
very tactile. And so to walk where they walked, to walk by Addison's Walk, where Lewis and Tolkien had their famous conversation, part of their conversation late night, to walk Addison's Walk and to imagine these two great minds having this amazing I think one of the most transformational conversations of the 20th century, if you think about it, the influence these two men have had. Right. And there it was on Addison's Walk, and you can go there. And it hasn't really changed much since 1931.
Not a lot in Oxford has.
Not exactly the point. That's great.
They keep that pretty much the same.
It's terrific.
How did those conversations about faith kind of influence the rest of their group? Is there any sense of like the other folks that they would hang out with if they were sort of like, all right, enough with the faith talk, or if they were all kind of on board, or they wanted it more literary, more political?
I think they were mostly on board. This is once Lewis became a believer in 1931, he and Tolkien became the nucleus for the Inklings, the two of them.
Right.
Lewis being the more gregarious of the two. And Lewis and Tolkien acknowledges this in his own letters. He says, you know, Lewis has a much greater capacity for friendship than I have. Tolkien, a little bit more reclusive, a little more withdrawn. But Lewis, very gregarious, and I think he just helped set the stage, the mood, with his humor, with, of course, with the hospitality there in his rooms. There's a point where Tolkien says, during the Second World War, he says, you know, here they are wondering if they're going to survive the Second World War, because the bombing of London, the bombing of various places around London, the suburbs, and he writes a letter to one of his sons and says, the Inklings have decided, if we survive this war, we're going to spend a week in an inn somewhere in the English countryside and drown ourselves in nothing but beer and talk. So they had a great Christian fellowship going on here. They were all mostly on the same page. Yeah,
that's good. We could work on something like that for America editors. Can we do that?
Field trip? Yeah, a little field trip.
I think that could work.
Well, it's interesting. Here are men who maybe at a different point in their lives might have been called to the priesthood or some sort of clerical life.
Yeah.
But that was not the path they chose, but they found community. They found ways to nurture their faith in other ways. So,
yes. And I think both of them were so deeply committed to communicating their understanding of the faith, Catholic and Lewis Anglican, as best they could through their God-given gifts. I mean, they clearly wanted to try to present these wonderful stories in a way that was consistent with their understanding of the great Christian story, the great biblical narrative.
Right, and it's important, I think, to note that these were lay men who brought this message, and that's something that I think people are still called upon to do. That, you know, we can't just always rely, perhaps, on the priests or the clergy among us to tell these stories. Everybody needs to be part of this evangelization.
Yes, they took it upon themselves to use their vocations in that way, and they were very, very deliberate about it. And if you think again about the 20s and 30s, the mood of cynicism. There's a quote from, I think, Virginia Woolf when she realizes that T.S. Eliot has converted to kind of Anglo Catholicism. She says, "He's dead to us now." This is the literary circle. It literally says, "He's dead to us, T.S. Eliot." I mean, that's the animus there was back in the 1930s and 40s toward faith. So imagine where we are now.
Right. And it's so interesting that, you know, I think bringing up these novels as something that really can tell us in many ways and about their authors, about some of the things that you sort of teach about public policy and about history and about religious liberty, all of these things really are tied up in the production of these great literary works, which I think is, you know, as an English major, you get people saying, oh, well, that's not a very useful thing to be. But if you look at all these works, especially in the context of this history, of all of these things that surround it, of the lives of their authors, it's really sort of fascinating. And it gets into that deeper truth that we were talking about before.
I think, let me just affirm your vocation. It's incredibly useful to be an English major, it seems to me, because so much of the expression of what's happening in our society and the culture comes out through its literature. You know,
in
very positive, constructive, hopeful ways or not, and that's part of their achievement, they're offering an alternative vision. It's not a two-dimensional vision. It's not an unrealistic vision, even though it's infused with this fantasy and myth and legend, right? But it has an incredibly realistic, relevant, right now kind of appeal, doesn't it? Because it represents the tragedy of the human condition, but also the potential for hope and redemption because of the grace of God, grace beyond us, right?
Right. Is there something that you learned about these men in your research that you didn't know that really surprised you that you think would surprise most listeners?
Well, that's a terrific question. I mean, there's a lot I learned about these men. I think the degree to which they were so out of step with their times and were really aware of that, and they probably thought in the back of their minds this could hurt us professionally to do what they were doing, writing these stories. Because if you're an Oxford professor, you need to be publishing, you know, Oxford articles in peer-reviewed journals about such and such a period and all the rest of it. And these guys are investing so much of their intellectual energies in these narrative works, these stories of good and evil rooted in this Christian narrative. And so I think appreciating how conscious they were that that was countercultural, it was deeply counterintuitive for their peers, and it cost them professionally, I think, at some level. It may have cost Lewis more than Tolkien, because he was so much more of an evangelist, outward evangelist, perhaps, than Tolkien was.
Right. And that's such an interesting question in our times when religious liberty is a topic that we talk about a lot.
Yes. Courage. Takes courage.
Yeah.
Now, do you see, in 50 years, 75 years, do you think these books are still going to be read? They're speaking about timeless issues in many ways, but do you think maybe Tolkien is more read these days than Lewis, or maybe that could change?
Yeah, you know, answering that question in a way maybe would be a little unexpected. I think, because the theme here is heroism in so many ways.
Yeah.
Heroism in the face of great evil and every individual's responsibility to join the right side. But what's, I think, so impressive about their understanding of heroism, which I think will have these long-lasting appeal, is that the heroism in their works is not like the heroism that we kind of produce here in Hollywood. In other words, the hero, unlike our Hollywood version, doesn't win the day, doesn't save the day by his or her natural strength, ability, and firepower. That's the modern hero, right? Lots of guns, lots of good looks, lots of smarts and talent. Their hero, think about it, Frodo, ultimately, at the end of his quest, despite all of his effort and strength, he fails. He fails in his quest. He will not destroy the ring. Instead, he says, I will not do what I came to do. The ring is mine. And then what happens? Gollum, this unlikely, horrid, wretched creature, so desperate for the ring, bites the finger off of Frodo that has the ring, and then falls into the crack of doom. And so the ring is destroyed not by Frodo, not by the Fellowship of the Ring. It's destroyed by, as Tolkien put it, a sudden and miraculous grace. Grace and goodness outside of ourselves that we don't possess in ourselves. That's a redemption story. And think about Lewis and the Chronicles of Narnia and the last battle, okay? The last battle. What happens? The children, they're forced into the stable. And in the stable, they believe is certain death. And then Poggin says, one of these creatures, Poggin says, oh, I could think of 1,000 deaths I would rather have died than to go into the stable. And they get in, and what happens? Aslan, the great lion, the Christ figure, he has cast out the demon Tash and opened up a portal to Aslan's country. He's done it, not the children. Again, this miraculous grace that comes from outside of them. And that was a deeply Christian idea that both Tolkien and Lewis understood. We can't save ourselves. Salvation and redemption comes from outside. That's why I think their stories ultimately will survive whatever the trend or the fad is in Hollywood and literature.
And it's a beautiful reminder to us today, you know, that we are part of something so much bigger than ourselves, that we have that access to that same grace.
Yes.
That it's
yes.
not just, it doesn't, and the beautiful thing is it's not fiction.
That's right.
For us.
That's
grace
right.
is a reality that actually right. that part is real. That part helps us live our everyday life. It helps us sort of, you know, be grace to each other when we
yes.
can be.
Yeah, such a deeply encouraging aspect of their story and their achievement, these two men.
Right. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about why you think the war, this aspect of the war and these two authors hasn't really been explored very much, at least that I've seen. This seems
That's
to be
a terrific question.
Kind
That's...
of a singular book.
Yeah. You know, I can only take a shot at that. You know, a partial answer to that question is we know a lot about the Second World War. It's closer to us. But the First World War seemed to have been fought for ambiguous reasons with ambiguous results. And yet the carnage of that war was, I think, something like 6,046 men died every day in that war, this war that lasted 4 years. And so we have this very ambiguous, almost indifferent attitude to the First World War. And we don't think about what an utterly catastrophic event it was. Winston Churchill, who fought in that war and then would go on to become Prime Minister of Great Britain, he said, you know, here it was, the civilized Christian nations of Europe had indulged in the worst kind of barbarous acts, and they restrained themselves only from, I think, cannibalism is how Churchill put it. They engaged in just about every other form of barbarism except cannibalism. So it was this mechanized, industrialized slaughter on this massive scale. It had never happened in the history of warfare. And so the military historians understand and devote plenty of attention to it. But think about it. We don't like to think about that war because it's so inconclusive. It seemed to have been fought for no good reason, but I wanted to draw attention to it because it had to have influenced these two men. I think it did.
Right. There's not a neat narrative there that
exactly.
you can pull out. Yeah.
Exactly.
No, I know. And that's what we look for often, is we want something that sort of makes sense. We want to put it in a context that is sort of easily digestible and understood. And
yeah.
that's just not the reality of war.
Yeah. Yeah. We don't have the kind of bad Nazis and good allied forces, right?
Right.
We have these various nations at each other's throats, men dying by the thousands every week. What comes out of that? And again, back to their achievement, they are not going to allow themselves to be overwhelmed by cynicism, doubt, agnosticism, and disillusionment. They're just not.
Again, the book is A Hobbit, A Wardrobe, and A Great War. The author is Joseph Loconte. Where, if people want to learn more about the book, obviously they can go online, but where they can learn more about you and your work?
Well, terrific. Thanks for asking, sir. They can go to my website, www.josephloconte.com. All my articles, and of course, you can order the book from there. It's available now on Amazon. Please visit.
All right, josephloconte.com.
Very good. Well, thank you very much, Joseph LeConte. We're really excited to have you on the show today. We're very grateful for your time, and we recommend your book. So this
Thanks
is,
so much.
And I'm Carrie Weber. I'm here with Tim Reedy. We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we're going to be speaking with Rona Tarrant about her reporting in Ireland and in New York City. You're listening to America This Week on the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129.
Thank you for listening to the podcast of America This Week, courtesy of the Catholic Channel on Sirius XM 129. If you want to hear the full show every week, subscribe to Sirius XM and tune in on Wednesdays at 1 p.m. Eastern to the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129.